The Arc 1015 having arrived, we call the House Tax Committee to order. Members, the agenda today, and again, there's not a whole lot of members here right now, so we're not officially calling a meeting to order until we have a quorum. But again, we want to stick to the conformity issues. Like I said, if you like the bill that was signed in law by the president in December, whether you like it or not, that's not the point. The point is how do we make it work for Minnesota? So to the testifiers, again, I will repeat that that's very important that we stick to how do we make conformity work, how does not conforming or conforming affect your constituents and so forth. So the agenda for today is we're looking at wrapping up with some member questions to the department. We're very honored to have Commissioner Bowerly here. And, of course, always as Mr. Cummings, who I heard is also known as the Pride of Grove City.
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Or was it Atwater?
No.
Oh, sorry. That was kind of nasty, wasn't it?
Mr. Chair, the Pride of Atwater is Representative Sarah Anderson.
There we go. So a lot of pride today in the Tax Committee. Okay. With that being said, so we know what we're doing here, we didn't get to have member questions to the department. We're going to do that, sticking to the conformity issue. And then we will go to House Research Nonpartisan, Mr. Michael, Mr. Williams. Then we'll go to Nonpartisan Fiscal, I believe Ms. Templin and Ms. Schill, or just Ms. Templin on this one? Ms. Templin on this one. Okay, and then we will get into, we've got a long, long list, as you can see. We may have to put some time limit on some folks here. But how many people that are on the list to testify are from over 50 miles away? I believe we had one group fly in. Okay, anybody else? Okay, the rest are roadies and groupies, and we can kind of just take them as is. So if not everybody gets on, we will make sure that you do get to testify here at some point. We do have a quorum. I'll officially call the meeting of the House Tax Committee to order. Representative Schultz moves the minutes of February 20th, 2018. Any additions or corrections? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Okay, thank you, members. Thank you, Representative Schultz. Okay, item one is welcome to the committee. So I'm going to open up for questions of Commissioner Bowerly and Mr. Cummings. We're going to start off the list that I had from the last meeting. Chairman Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I forgot that I was on the list to ask questions, so I was looking for my notes from last time. But as I'll go off memory as best I can. When the federal tax bill was passed, there were several different groups that calculated the total amount of additional debt, anywhere between $500 billion to $2 trillion. If you ask conservative sources, it was $500 billion in debt that it added over 10 years. If you ask liberal sources, it was $2 trillion, and most people agree it's somewhere between $1 and $1.5 trillion. So when, I'm not going to lie, when the news first came out of it and we heard talk about conformity, I'm like, the federal government can deficit spend, but we cannot. I realize we budget for every 2 years, okay, so we don't need to take necessarily into consideration those tails. But what I'm trying to figure out is if we were to conform in total, what impact would that have in total on our deficit in the tails? And secondly, what kind of impact does that have in terms of difference between the federal government, who can deficit spend, and we who cannot? And I'm going to ask this based on the fact if it was a total conformity, because I realize, Mr. Chair, you're not talking about total conformity necessarily. We're talking about something, but as much apples to apples if you can.
Chair Lesh, could we keep you on the list when we get to House Nonpartisan Fiscal maybe, or does the department wish to take down, or would that be more appropriate for fiscal?
Is it?
We have
okay.
The numbers.
Oh, okay.
For fiscal, so put Lesh top for...
Sure. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Lesh. Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think I have a question and a comment. My question is really if the department, as we move forward, will be able to identify the specific quintiles or groups of taxpayers who are going to be most impacted by this tax conformity issue. I know it's rather broad and sweeping. We did quite a few things to provide tax relief in Minnesota last year, and I'd like to, you know, better understand where our efforts could be most targeted. As for my comment, thank you, Commissioner Bowerly and Mr. Cummins, for your report. And I know that you don't make the laws, you just enforce them. But during your presentation, I think that words matter, and we oftentimes at the legislature here call things differently than they are. We often call spending investments. We call taxes investments. And a couple days ago, I heard quite a bit the perpetual reference of what are really taxpayer hostages as customers. And I view customers as a principal in a transaction of one or more persons who do so voluntarily without the force of law or coercion. So if they're truly customers, they would choose to behave differently than the consequences that happen. So I'd like to have you use consistently the term taxpayer and not a customer.
Commissioner Bowerly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hertas. First, as to your question of the impact on particular Minnesotans, as you noted, every individual taxpayer situation may be different, and so this bill could, at the federal level, for their federal taxes, impact them in very different ways. And so, of course, whatever reaction we have here in Minnesota could also have various impacts on them. If there are specific provisions you would like us to take a look at, we can certainly try to do that. I think our teams have been working very hard to understand those impacts and are developing models that will allow us to look at that by income levels. I think one of the other factors that I know there's been a lot of conversation around is family size, which matters as well, particularly with the change to the dependent exemptions. As to your comment, Representative Hertas, if I may, we do think of taxpayers as our customers because it's our job to deliver excellent customer service while helping Minnesotans comply with their obligations under Minnesota tax law. So we approach Minnesotans in that way, meaning that we try to provide them with excellent customer service. We provide them with the information that they need to comply with the tax laws of Minnesota. You're correct. We don't make the laws. That is your responsibility. But when those laws are passed and enacted, then it's our job to help make sure Minnesotans have the opportunity. The vast majority of Minnesotans are completely interested in complying with their obligations under the law, and it's our job to help them have the resources and the tools that they need, whether that's a filing system, that's an electronic filing system, or the forms that they may need, a customer service line where they can call and ask questions, or whether for those who choose not to comply, part of our job is to make it fair for all Minnesotans. And so we do work with all of ours. And our goal is customer service. Whether individuals identify themselves as taxpayers or customers, we treat all of our interactions with the public as our customers.
Thank you. Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Morning, Commissioner Bowerly, Mr. Cummins, and we've had thousands of Minnesotans that paid their property taxes early last year because they assumed they would be treated on those with the ability to deduct them like they have in the past. And could you characterize for us what your department has been doing in that discussion and what the relationship with the IRS has been on that and what those discussions have been, where we're at, and I'm just curious why we're even contemplating treating those early payments differently than we have in the past.
Commissioner Bowerly.
Mr. Chair and Chair Drazkowski, as you may recall, shortly after the law was enacted at the federal level, the IRS in late December issued an advisory, which is one form of the IRS's types of guidance that it can issue. And it advised that it put some parameters around the types of deductions or how that in prepayments could be treated. This ultimately will be an IRS decision as to whether they allow those prepayments to be deducted in for 17 and 18. And we have reached out to the IRS to ask them for further guidance to convey the questions that we've been receiving at the Department of Revenue, and that we will provide any follow-up information we receive from the IRS as soon as we receive it. But ultimately, this is an IRS determination, not a state determination, because it's how the IRS will treat those prepayments under the new federal law.
Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Commissioner, has the IRS asked for your department's input, ideas, thoughts, or opinions on that?
Commissioner Bowerly?
Chair Davis, Chair Drazkowski, it has not.
Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Knobloch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, in your testimony on Tuesday, you said something to the effect that it was the department's policy that any elections that people took on their federal tax returns would also be elections that you would say they had taken on their state returns. Now, I recall there's some sort of famous Minnesota Supreme Court decision that says that the federal government can't pass a law that by passing it forces us to change our law. And so my question is, if we don't do something in regard to conformity this year, and a person files their tax returns and chooses to take the standard deduction at the federal level, are you saying that they can't treat their taxes for the state taxes as being calculated the way they would have used to have calculate them regarding taking itemized deductions at the state level? Because, I mean, normally they, in coming up with their federal taxable income, you know, doing it the old way, they would have taken itemized deductions. Now they'd be deciding to take a standard deduction at the federal level, but you're saying that because of the federal tax law, you wouldn't let them calculate their starting point for their state income tax with itemized deductions. Is that right?
Mr. Bowerly?
Mr. Chair and Chair Knobloch, it's the department's, and it, I do want to be clear, we were citing to our position, the department's position under Minnesota statute, so it is not just a policy of the department. Minnesota statute 290.01 subdivision 19 discusses the connection between those federal elections and the state elections. And so that's the source of where our position comes from. And, yes, that would be the consequence of that statute. So I don't think that it is the same as I think you might have been referring to Wallace, which found that we couldn't sort of pre-conform, as some states are allowed to federal changes. But we don't think that would be the issue.
Chair Knobloch.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your presentation the other day, plus whatever you said today, okay? I just have a couple comments with a question. Is that, you know, when I look at your analysis here, it appears that the individual income taxpayers, at least some of them, are going to pay $163,980,000 more, according to your analysis. So we have individual income taxpayers in 2019 based on the federal tax reform bill paying more. And the other areas, the primary area, is the corporate franchise tax, which is $292,300,000, which together, I guess, plus with 2020 totals that $800 and some million in total increased taxes for about 10% of the taxpayers in the state of Minnesota. So my point is that, you know, I'm firmly convinced that lower taxes create higher tax revenue, okay, which is what I think we all want, regardless of party. It just, you know, one side maybe wants to grow government more, the other side wants to reduce government. But so I would just strongly urge us to conform to the federal tax and to also reduce taxes on these areas that are hit, that are paying the most. And, you know, just one follow-up comment before I get to my question. You know, in January, after the federal tax bill was passed, it was the first month where federal tax revenues exceeded federal tax expenditures in a long time. So just 1 month of the tax cut, and, of course, billions of dollars have come back into our economy, federal tax revenues exceeded federal tax expenditures by $50 billion, okay? So lower tax, a reasonable tax and regulatory system creates higher tax revenue. And, you know, repetition is the key to learning. So my question is, are you prepared to work with us to identify those areas where we need to reduce taxes, where some Minnesota citizens are going to experience higher taxes because of the federal tax reform?
Commissioner Bowerly?
Chair Davids and Representative Greenhagen, as we shared in our proposal, one of our goals with the department is to make sure that we have the information to create a response to the federal tax bill that will work for all Minnesotans. And as you pointed out, and I know that the fiscal staff here in the House will be walking through the estimate, there certainly, if there were to be sort of straight or sort of total conformity, there would be a significant amount of money raised, in part because of the way the federal government changed or the federal law changes, particularly the standard deduction, the interaction with that, and the removal of the personal exemptions. At this point in Minnesota, we don't have the replacement for that federal child tax credit that was a part of that bill. So absolutely, I think there are a lot of conversations that we all need to have to consider the impacts across Minnesotan on Minnesotans and across family sizes to make sure that we are doing our best to mitigate, if you will, the challenges created by the federal bill for Minnesota.
Ms. Chair?
President Brunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Ms. Chair. I consider that to be a yes then, so I look forward to a proposal that helps me as a representative understand what taxes need to be reduced and on who or groups in order to make this conformity not a tax increase for any Minnesota businesses or individuals. Okay? I thank you for that.
Okay. Representative Wells?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Drazkowski addressed what I was going to ask about, but I wanted to follow up on the question because I've been hearing from several constituents very concerned about the prepayment of their property taxes and what this is going to mean for them. So I guess I would just encourage the department, if you're able to contact the IRS and push for a decision as soon as possible so we can have resolution and an answer for our constituents.
Thank you, Representative Wolf.
Thank you.
And members, we're going to continue with member questions until about 10:45. Then we need to get to research, fiscal, and then some testimony. But I have my list, and if you're on my list, you will be on my list for questions of the department at another time. Because as I'm sure you know, I think I said last time that the department has basically free reign of the tax committee as far as time. We are not going to be, I think the department is going to be so important, well, they are, of course, but to members' questions. And so I want the department to be here to inform members of this committee as you wish. And so we will just, so I'm not going to be cutting anybody off, but we'll just cut the line and then come back to it another time. Chair Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, first of all, a comment, and I won't use a name because then that generates further discussion, but I agree with an earlier comment that words matter, but I do like the word investment. That's the word that matters to me, and I had for 20-some years chaired one education committee or another, and I always used the word investment, investment in education, investment in our workforce. And I think both sides of the aisle use that. But at any rate, I did have a couple of questions. Page 6 of your presentation the other day, you referenced protecting taxpayers from refund fraud. And cybersecurity has been an issue I've been quite concerned about, and I know you've had requests in. So just very quickly, in the interest of time, where do we stand with the whole issue of cyber security, And then I have a follow-up question as well.
And again, members, I'm going to show some latitude here, but I really want to talk about conformity. But
Mr. Chairman, it was in the presentation the other day. That's why I'm asking the question.
Oh, I didn't read. Oh, I mean, I read it thoroughly.
It's page six. It's page six.
Okay. Good point. Thank you. Point well taken. Commissioner Bowerly.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and Representative Carlson, we take very seriously at the Department of Revenue our obligation to protect all of the data that is provided through the tax process, whether that's coming in from payments or from tax returns. And so we work closely with our partners at Minute at Revenue to make sure that we have in place robust security measures to protect all of the data that we have. We also work hard to ensure that criminals are not able to steal refunds from the state of Minnesota by posing as real Minnesotans. And so we take the time that we need to review refunds and returns to make sure that we are getting at that new sort of form of cybercrime. Used to be that identity thieves would open a new credit card in your name. Now they're coming after tax refunds, and so we're working hard on that as well. And we'd be happy to provide more detail on our efforts in that space.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, we can explore that a bit later. I know the department has had funding requests on that particular issue, and that's what I meant by where you stood today. I know you've been working on the issue, which you just said, but I think my question, and we can talk about it later, is how we move forward. Because you did have initiatives, and I'm not sure where those initiatives currently stand in terms of the overall need. But my other question does clearly deal with, as you're defining the topic, but again, the other day you talked about the need for upgrading the staff, training the staff. And my question there then, I'll call it continuing education. Are you going to have a supplementary budget request in that regard, or are you going to be able to handle that continuing education with the new tax changes internally with your current budget?
Commissioner Bowerly?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Carlson, as we mentioned on Tuesday, Chair Anderson has made a request of us to identify any additional costs that will be incurred by the department to administer the Minnesota tax code absent any action by the legislature, so our current status. So we are working on that request to make sure that we have thought through all of the implications for our staff in terms of how we are serving our customers, the form changes, all of that work that we described for you on Tuesday, and the cost that will go with that. I also anticipate, Mr. Chair and members, that proposals to respond to the federal bill to conform or in certain ways, we may also have fiscal notes that we would offer with those bills as well. So we want to be as completely clear with the committee about the level of effort that responding to the federal bill will cause for the department, assuming that we want to maintain our current service levels. I think it will be incredibly difficult for us to maintain our current service levels if we don't have new funds, regardless of the outcome of this session. And, of course, the scope of the work will depend on what happens during session.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, the reason I raise that question, as some of us are very aware, the forecast comes out on the 28th, and then the question of a supplementary bill comes up, and in terms of what that bill will ultimately contain, I'm assuming that the governor will have supplementary budget proposals. I've not talked with Chair Knobloch to know yet what the majority party's plans are relative to a supplemental budget, but there are things out there that I'm sure will need to be addressed one way or another. So thank you.
And Chair Carlson, I apologize to you on the cybersecurity part. That is, members, on page 6. It was part of the department's
Oh, you looked. No, they didn't use the word cybersecurity, but they talked about, yeah.
And I do know that in the past, in talking with Commissioner Bowerly, that's been a very big part of the department to make sure that everything is that's very important. So thank you, Chair Carlson. Chair Anderson.
I'll save it for a different time.
Okay. Chair Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, a process question. With the creation of the Legislative Budget Office, are revenue notes still coming from Department of Revenue, or are those brought over here?
Commissioner Bowerly?
Mr. Chair and Representative Grafflo, it's my understanding that the change for the legislative budget office did not include revenue estimates.
Okay. So, Mr. Chairman,
Chair Grafflo,
for the department, does Minnesota have a corporate AMT right now?
Commissioner Barber.
Mr. Chair and Representative Grafflo, yes.
Okay. So my question, just a couple quick questions here. I couldn't remember that. Sorry. The federal tax bill changed us from a system, a worldwide system of taxation, to a territorial system. And that's obviously very complicated. But from a compliance standpoint, from an administration standpoint, assuming that revenue, we were to conform with the federal side, what does that mean in terms of your workload of administration? Is it harder? Is it less? Is it more? Is it the same?
Commissioner Bauer.
Mr. Chair and Representative Grafflo, under current Minnesota law, foreign income is already subject to taxation under certain provisions. So, of course, if that scope were to be expanded, there could be additional work as well there, and that is part of the analysis that we're doing in response to Chair Anderson's request in terms of if we do nothing, and then, of course, if there are proposals to expand the scope or conform with the federal government on those foreign income provisions, we will have information about that as well. So we are continue to study that.
Yeah. Mr. Chair.
Chair Grafflo.
Thank you. So it depends, basically, right? Okay, fair enough. And then on the issue of the SALT cap at 10,000, the state and local tax deduction at 10,000, obviously Minnesota is kind of in the same bucket as places like California and New York. For those who pay their property taxes early, does the IRS have, is there any delineation of what was prepaid versus current paid? So when I think of the Schedule A, I think of it just has a line for property taxes, or takes property taxes, license tabs, income taxes, just consolidates it into one number. Does the department, does the IRS have any way of separating that out unless the filer does it on their own?
Commissioner Bauerle?
Mr. Chair and Representative Grafflo, we have been receiving questions like that from preparers and tax professionals and individuals, and those are some of the questions that we have passed along to the IRS in terms of how do they, you know, customers are looking for information about how the IRS is going to implement and follow up on its advisory and how it will define that for different states, because, of course, different states have different systems with respect to property taxes. So we don't know the answer to that question. Again, in hearing the interest of the committee and the concerns, we will redouble our efforts to communicate with the IRS and ask them again to help provide more specific information to states like Minnesota.
Chair Grafflo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And it's one of the few times where I want to hear from the IRS, so that's good news. I do want to just highlight for you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, obviously this $10,000 cap starting in tax year 18 on state and local tax deductions, it made a really good federal bill less good, and it impacts a lot of Minnesota ratepayers, and I would hope that I would hope as we're going forward that we take that into our consideration, that this is actually, it's the net effect of this is almost like a fifth tier on Minnesota income taxpayers, and it's providing yet another financial incentive for high-income individuals to have a lower tax burden by moving out of state. And I would hope that as discussions go forward with the administration that be something that we're taking a look at. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Grafflo. I think we're going to make it here. One follow-up from Chair Knobloch, and then we're going to House Research. Chair Knobloch.
Okay, thanks for allowing this follow-up to my earlier question, Mr. Chair. So, Commissioner Bauerle, when I first got into this, I thought that other than repatriation, where we have some significant state corporate tax coming into the state, even if we don't do any conformity, I guess I thought that we were relatively revenue neutral on conformity. But now you're saying that you're going to treat any election on the federal level as a state election, even regardless of whether we do anything with conformity or not. Well, that's going to have an effect on our state tax revenue. Do you have an estimate of how much additional money or how much less money we're going to get as a state by treating all of our taxpayers' federal elections as now being state elections?
Commissioner Bowerly.
Mr. Chair and Chair Knobloch, the revenue estimate that I believe House Fiscal will be walking through does have information about that. There will be forecast adjustments. Information has been transmitted to the state's forecasters about both repatriation and this election issue. I also just want to be clear that this is not a new position. It's not a new reading of Minnesota statute. We acknowledge, as we said on Tuesday, that the differences between federal law and state law are now larger and that they do produce different results, but that doesn't change our position under the statute as it was. So I think I'll leave it to House Fiscal staff to walk you through the numbers, in particular on the estimate.
Chair Knobloch.
All right, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Commissioner. Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, as your fiscal staff and House research staff is coming up, I guess we wanted to send a sincere thank you to them. They have been working on the House income tax simulation model and other forms of modeling with our research and attorneys, and we wanted to thank them for their analysis as we're all trying to get our heads around this bill. So Mr. Michael, Mr. Williams, Ms. Templin, and others have really been working hard with our staff, and we'd like to thank them.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Thank you very much for that. Okay, if you have questions of Mr. Cummings or Commissioner Bowerly, they're certainly open to taking your phone calls or notes or whatever here. So let's go to Mr. Michael and Mr. Williams, and then they're going to have a presentation. You should have a PowerPoint, or maybe not. Yes. We have that. Oh, members, that should be, their PowerPoint should be in your save file. Let's see. Here we go. 2017 federal tax reform legislation. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Sean Williams from the Nonpartisan Research Department.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So to start with my presentation, I'm going to maybe belabor the point a little bit that the Department of Revenue mentioned on Tuesday about how Minnesota taxable income is calculated. And that's Minnesota taxable income starts from federal taxable income. So that is the starting point for our tax system. And you sort of need to understand how that is calculated in order to understand the effects that the conformity to the federal law would have on our state taxes. So this flowchart shows you that the way that federal taxable income is calculated, it starts with gross income. That's essentially all income from a taxpayer, so wages, capital gains, dividends, business income and losses. You from that subtract adjustments, those are also known as above-the-line deductions. It's things like student loan interest, moving interest, IRA contributions, and things, other deductions. That gets you adjusted gross income. From adjusted gross income, you would subtract either the standard deduction or the taxpayer's itemized deduction. You would subtract the personal and dependent exemptions, and that would get you federal taxable income. From there, Minnesota sort of breaks off from the federal system. We subtract our own subtractions. We add our own additions, and that gets you Minnesota taxable income. Then we apply our rates in brackets to get the tax before credits, and then apply our credits to get the tax after credits. I would note that there's several provisions that happen on the federal side after Minnesota sort of diverges from the federal system. So that's the application of federal rates and brackets, and that's the application of non-refundable and refundable credits. So one of the changes that makes conformity somewhat challenging is there are changes to the personal and dependent exemptions sort of above the point where Minnesota breaks off from the federal system. Those are offset at the federal level by changes that happen after Minnesota breaks off from the federal system. So the dependent exemption is repealed in the federal system, and it's sort of offset at the federal level by changes in the federal child credit, but those are applied after Minnesota diverges from the federal system. Minnesota is one of six states that use federal taxable income as a tax base. Minnesota, Colorado, Idaho, North Dakota, South Carolina, and Vermont are the states that use federal taxable income. Other states use federal adjusted gross income. So that means that they have their own, in some cases, personal dependent exemptions or child credits. And so they are less affected by having to conform to the federal law as a result of that. There's eight states that use gross income or their own definition of income as a starting point, and nine states have no income tax. I would note that among the states that use a federal adjusted gross income base, their standard deductions vary. So in 19 of the 27 states, they actually have a smaller standard deduction than the federal standard deduction in tax year 2017, sort of before the law. And 8 of the 27 states have standard deductions that are equal to or greater than the federal standard deduction. So there's a little bit more flexibility for those states with regards to federal conformity because they don't have to mechanically conform to this large increase in the standard deduction. They can sort of set their own standard deduction as they would like. I'm now going to discuss a number of provisions in the federal tax law that would affect Minnesota's income tax directly. I'm not going to discuss everything, but I'm sort of going to try and focus on sort of the most important provisions that have an effect on Minnesota liability. I would first note that the provisions of the Federal Tax Cuts and Jobs Act are scheduled to expire. So the changes to individual taxes under that law expire on December 31st, 2025, unless Congress acts to extend them or make them permanent. So if Congress takes no action, the tax system would sort of revert to old law in tax year 2026. So when I'm discussing provisions in this presentation, I'll say that provisions are repealed or that brackets are changed, but they are technically suspended, and then they revert back to the old law in prior to tax year 2026. And I'm going to note a couple of instances where provisions the date for provisions expiration is different than the expiration at the end of 10 years. So the first change that I mentioned is the repeal of the dependent and personal exemptions. So under old law, taxpayers would have subtracted $4,150 for each exemption they received in tax year 2018. The personal exemption would be you would receive two personal exemptions if you were married filing jointly, and you would receive one personal exemption if you were filing with another status. Under the new federal law, that provision is repealed. It's offset for some filers by an increase in the standard deduction, and I'll sort of show you how that works in a later slide about the standard deduction. But there's no offset for filers who continue to itemize in the future. The dependent exemption, under old law, all filers would receive one dependent exemption for each dependent they had. And under the new law, that provision is repealed. It's replaced by an expansion of the federal child credit for children 16 and younger, and the creation of a new sort of $500 credit for dependents who don't qualify for the federal child credit. Another major change under the new law is a significant increase in the standard deduction. So if you look at the table in your packets, you can see sort of what the standard deduction was projected to have been under tax year 2018 under old law, and then the combined amount of that plus what the personal exemption would have been. So for a taxpayer that's claiming the standard deduction under old law, they would have received, for example, for a married couple filing jointly, they would have received $2,300 combined from the standard deduction and their personal exemptions. And under the new law, they'll receive a $24,000 standard deduction. So that's an increase. So if the state were to conform to these new higher levels as part of a conformity bill, standard deduction filers under old law would see a federal and state tax decrease because they're receiving a larger standard deduction than the old amounts they received through the combined standard deduction and personal exemption. The federal law also contains a number of changes to exclusions from income and above-the-line deductions. So exclusions for incomes are items that are just not reported as income. They're not deductions. So an example would be the exclusion for employer reimbursement for bicycle commuting expenses. If your employer reimburses you for bicycle commuting expenses, you just don't report that on your taxes, and you would now have to. Similarly, there's an exclusion for qualified moving expense reimbursements. So if your employer reimburses you for qualified moving expenses, that's no longer excluded for income except for members of the armed forces. The federal law also repeals some above-the-line deductions, so the deduction for moving expenses and also the deduction for alimony payments, effective only for divorces and separations executed after December 31st this year. There's also another number of changes to itemized deductions. We've talked about a few of them already. I'll sort of go over them at a high level. So there's modifications to the existing deduction for home mortgage interest. First, there's a repeal of the deductibility of interest on home equity loans, and there's a reduction in the amount of acquisition indebtedness that is eligible to receive the mortgage interest deduction. It used to be $1 million. It will be $750,000, and that's only effective for indebtedness occurred after December 15th, 2017. So essentially, it's only for newer mortgages. It doesn't apply to older mortgages. There's also a repeal of the casualty and theft loss deduction. So those two changes, because they are repeals or sort of limitations on existing deductions, people will see a federal tax increase if they used to claim those deductions and they continue to itemize. and they will also receive a state tax increase. The charitable contributions deduction, there used to be a limitation that limited your charitable contributions to 50% of your adjusted gross income. The federal tax law actually increases that floor to 60% of your adjusted gross income. So for a small number of filers, they will actually be able to deduct more charitable contributions, so they'll actually see a federal tax decrease as a result of that provision and a state tax decrease. We've discussed this already a little bit today, but there was significant modifications to the taxes paid deduction, also known as the state and local taxes deduction. So first I would say that businesses retain the right to deduct their taxes other than personal income taxes on individual business owners. Individuals may deduct up to $10,000 or $5,000 for married couples filing separately of state and local property, income or sales, war profits, and excess profits tax. That limitation is not indexed for inflation. And so those provisions to the, would result in federal tax increases because if, for people who previously claimed those deductions and would continue to itemize because their deduction is limited. The effect on Minnesota liability is actually blunted somewhat because you are already adding back your state income taxes to on your state income tax return. You can't deduct your state income taxes from your state income taxes. And so the result of that provision is it has a smaller effect on Minnesota taxes than it does on federal taxes because we were already sort of disallowing a deduction of state income taxes. Some other itemized deductions that changed were the medical expense deduction. This is a confusing one, but under old law, taxpayers could deduct medical expenses in excess of 10% of their adjusted gross income. In tax years prior to tax year 2017 only, the adjusted gross income floor was 7.5% for filers ages 65 and older. The new federal law lowers that floor to 7.5% for all filers, but it is effective for only tax years 2018 and 2019. So in 2020, it would revert back to old law, which is the 10% floor. That provision is an increase in the medical expense deduction, so it actually would result for filers that claim it and itemize their deductions. It would result in a federal and a state tax decrease. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act also repeals sort of what are called miscellaneous and itemized deductions on the miscellaneous itemized deductions on the Schedule A. Those are deductions that are subject to the 2% adjusted gross income floor. It's things like expenses for the production or collection of income, tax preparation expenses, and unreimbursed employee expenses. So the net effect of all of these provisions, we've done some preliminary modeling. Under old law, we sort of forecast that about 63% of filers would claim the standard deduction in tax year 2018 and 36% would itemize in Minnesota. And under the sort of conformity to the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, we would expect 86.7% of filers to claim the standard deduction. So there's a pretty significant shift of people from itemizing onto the standard deduction. And that's a combination of people claiming fewer itemized deductions due to the limitations I discussed and also the increases in the standard deduction. So both of those changes are moving people onto the standard deduction. One item I would note here is Minnesota has a subtraction for charitable contributions for individuals who claim the federal standard deduction. So sort of a counterintuitive effect of this of conformity would be that people who previously itemized would switch to the federal standard deduction, then those people would receive a new state subtraction for a portion of their charitable contributions. And so in our preliminary modeling, we estimated that about $200 million or so, $198, was forecast to be subtracted in tax year 2018. And we expect under conformity that about $712 million would be subtracted for that provision under tax year 2018. So it has a pretty significant tens of millions of dollars in terms of the revenue effect of that. Sure. Mr. Chair and Representative Garofalo, so the way to think about it is a taxpayer previously itemized their deductions. They receive a larger standard deduction under the new federal law than they received under the old federal law, and then the amount of itemized deductions they had. And so they claim the federal standard deduction. At the state level, they are newly eligible for this subtraction that is only available to filers who claim the standard deduction. And it's a subtraction for charitable contributions. It's 50% of charitable contributions in excess of $500. And so you're not getting the full amount of that charitable contribution subtraction back, but you are getting an increase. You're newly eligible for a subtraction that you didn't receive under old law. Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, another change in under the federal law is a change to inflation indexing. So the new federal tax system will move from the consumer price index for all urban consumers to the chain consumer price index for all urban consumers. Without getting too much into the weeds on that, the chain consumer price index sort of accounts for the ability of consumers to change their consumption habits when prices change because they can substitute goods that have gone up in price for other goods. The chain consumer price index also, for all urban consumers, also uses different weights in sort of identifying the basket of goods that is used to calculate inflation, and those weights are sort of more recent. They're calculated based on more recent consumption data. The sort of net effect of this change is that chain CPI tends to increase more slowly than CPIU. So the result of that is that a lot of different provisions in federal law that are indexed for inflation will grow more slowly. There's sort of effects of this that are moving in both directions. So things like the standard deduction, that will grow more slowly, but also the brackets will grow more slowly and things like that. So the net, I think that there's sort of differing net effects in terms of revenue of those provisions. The other thing I would note is that change is permanent, so it's not one of the provisions that repeals at the end of 10 years. Without getting into too much detail, because I think that the discussion is supposed to focus on the issue of conformity, there's a number of provisions of the federal law that don't affect Minnesota tax liability. So changes in federal rates and brackets, changes to the federal child credit, changes to the federal alternative minimum tax, and repeal of the federal itemized deduction limitation. Minnesota has its own statutory itemized deduction limitation, so that would continue to be in effect after, even if we were to conform to the federal law. Although the federal, the repeal of the federal itemized deduction limitation may have a small effect on liability because that will also move people off of the standard deduction and to itemizing if they were previously limited in their itemized deductions, which would make them newly which would make them no longer eligible for that state subtraction for charitable contributions. So I'm going to discuss a little bit about sort of hypothetical taxpayers that are likely to see tax increases under a conformity law. I want to note that this assumes that what we do, what Mr. Michael has been calling mechanical conformity, so that would be just updating our statutory references to the Internal Revenue Code. This is sort of what the revenue assessment assumed that, or the revenue estimate that the Department of Revenue prepared. This is the policy they're assuming would have been implemented. I would note that that includes no family size adjustment, so because we're no longer having the dependent exemption, we're not adjusting people's tax liability for the size of their families, and that's sort of a universal system of tax codes. So it seems very unlikely that this policy would be implemented as it's described in the revenue estimate. But if you were to implement the policy, I think that this gives you some sense of sort of the effects of conformity alone, and then you can use that sort of as a baseline against which to compare other policy proposals. So the, I'd say that one of the largest changes is that filers with dependents will see tax increases. That's unless Minnesota comes up with some sort of, excuse me. That would,
a little bit under weather.
Take your breath away.
That is water you're drinking, right?
It is. So filers with dependents would see tax increases. That would assume that Minnesota doesn't provide its own sort of family size adjustment, like a child credit or its own dependent exemption. Filers who previously itemized their deductions and continue to do so under conformity would also see tax increases. Mr. Michael, you want to pick this up for me?
Okay.
Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Joel Michael from House Research. So the next point of the taxpayers who are likely to see tax increases are those who itemize and continue to itemize because the federal government repealed the personal exemption. And so effectively they would lose their personal exemption. For a married couple, that's like having an extra $8,000 of taxable income. The additional people who will lose, obviously, are people who have property taxes that exceed $10,000 and continue to itemize. They don't get enough from the standard deduction to offset that. Other possibilities, if you have casualty loss deductions or you had moving expense deductions, that those would also be categories of people that lose. So who's likely to be a winner under this sort of just rote conformity or mechanical conformity? Filers who don't have dependents and claim the standard deduction, they're going to benefit from that substantial increase that Congress enacted. Similarly, filers who itemized but had itemized deductions that weren't a lot above the standard deduction, and the standard deduction increase will swamp that. Filers who itemized under old law and shifted to the standard deduction under the new federal law that were newly eligible for the charitable contribution subtraction, so that may offset some of that effect. And there are also people that people who are eligible for additional itemized deductions as a result of the changes in the floors on the phase-outs. With that, I'll switch over and talk about the business provisions, and I just want to emphasize what Mr. Williams said, that the Revenue Department review of this was at the 30,000-foot level, and I think we're at the 20,000-foot level, so we're not down on the ground yet. The rule that I use to decide which of these business provisions I'm covering is ones that the Department of Revenue, in their revenue estimate, shows has a plus or minus $10 million a year effect in fiscal 19 on businesses. The federal changes have a myriad of changes on businesses, and we just can't get into all of those. So to go through, the first one that I'm going to cover is the qualified business income deduction. This has frequently been talked about as the 20% deduction for pass-through entities. There's no analog in prior law for this. Basically, it allows, sole proprietors, partners, shareholders, and S-corps to deduct 20% of their income if they satisfy a really complex set of rules that are written into the new federal law. Those limits are based on how much income you have. If your income's low enough, you'll qualify no matter what kind of business you're in. But if your income is above that threshold and you're in one of the bad lines of business, so if you're a doctor, lawyer, or a variety of other kinds of service businesses like that.
Mr. Michael, what about financial advice?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I know what you're going to ask. I'm sorry. If your income is too high and you're in the wrong business, you're out of luck, except that the CPAs will probably figure out a way to qualify some of your income if you're willing to be aggressive. If you're not in one of those in those wrong lines of business, then there's a rule that says you got to satisfy some other requirements, like 20% of W-2 wages that you paid. That's a limitation, or alternatively, 2.5% of your qualified basis. This deduction is also available if you're an investor in a REIT or a master limited partnership. You get the deduction. As I suspect many of you have heard, there's a glitch in the law. At the last minute, Congress said, gee, we didn't cover co-ops and farmers in co-ops, so they added something. But, of course, when you do things hurriedly, you often make mistakes. So they gave a 20% of the gross deduction to people when you sell, if you sell to a co-op. If that sticks, and I don't believe it will, because Senator Grassley has said they're going to fix it, and, he usually has a fair amount of sway on farm tax provisions, so I'm expecting Congress will fix that. But if they don't, I think you can assume that most farmers will sell to co-ops and won't pay federal tax. This is a very peculiar deduction in that it's not an above-the-line deduction. It's not an itemized deduction. It's sort of a hybrid between the two. It does affect FTI, though, so if we conform mechanically, we would pick this up, and it's a big cost item. As you see on the slide, revenue is estimating that the cost of this is $353 million in fiscal 19. The next provision is Section 179. Congress expanded the availability of Section 179, which I suspect most of you know we have not conformed to before. Prior law had a $500,000 limit. They increased that to $1 million. The phase-out went from $2 million to $2.5 million. More types of property will qualify than before. There are certain kinds of real property that will qualify. And as I said, Minnesota has not conformed in the past. We require 80% of this to be added back and then allow the remainder to be deducted over 5 years. If we stick with that method, this is a revenue raiser in the short run, although it's just a timing change. But if we decide this is the opportunity to actually conform with this, it's a cost. And you can see on the slide the difference. It's a, if we decide that, hey, we should switch and actually conform, and I'll get the a provision later that may suggest why you might want to think about that, it would be an $85 million cost. But if we don't, it's an $8 million raiser. The next provision is bonus depreciation. And, again, this is part of Congress was economists have long argued that the tax ought to allow what's called expensing of assets, and that the Section 179 and bonus depreciation effectively do that. Again, this is something we have chosen in the past not to conform to. The department touched on this before, and so I won't go to it through it too much. The big thing is that used property now qualifies. It used to be you could only get bonus depreciation if you bought something new. Now you can buy used property and qualify for that. If you were to decide this is the time to conform on bonus depreciation, it's a big revenue reduction. You can see on the slide it's over $340 million in reduction. But if we stick with our current system, which is, again, this 80% and then 5 years, then it's a fairly substantial revenue raiser of $61 million. And, again, all of these are one-year numbers, not biennial numbers. The next provision is the loss limitation rule. Current law, there, as you suspect many of you are familiar with, there are passive loss rules that say if you're an investor, a passive investor, your losses are limited. If you're an active investor, you can take your losses from one business and offset income from wages or investment income from other activities. Congress now is saying as a way to raise revenue to provide for their bonus depreciation and rate cuts that they're doing, they're going to impose limits on that. If your losses from one business are more than $500,000, then you can't deduct the amount over $500,000 to reduce income from another activity. And revenue has estimated that that will raise $58 million in 1 year. Small business accounting reform. This relates to the businesses that can use cash basis rather than accrual basis accounting. The prior federal rules were fairly restrictive in which businesses could use cash basis accounting, because if you talk to accountants, accrual accounting does a much better job of reflecting economic reality, but it's way more complex. And having served on boards, I know people get confused by accrual accounting all the time. So Congress is expanding by quite a bit the number of businesses that can qualify to use cash basis accounting. Most farms use it under prior law. More farm businesses will be able to use it, and the small business threshold goes from $5 million of gross receipts to $25 million, and the inventory rules are loosened up. This is going to reduce when we conform to it by about $69 million. And I would say, as a flag, just the department tried to talk when we last met about the challenges of failing to conform, and they used a couple examples. This would be my poster child for the difficulty of if you do not address this, because you would be saying to businesses, you can be a cash basis taxpayer for federal purposes, but Minnesota, you got to do accrual accounting. That just would be a nightmare. The next provision is interest deduction. Under prior law, interest deduction, pretty much fully deductible. There are esoteric rules about various things that limit that. But one of the things with allowing expensing is economists say, hey, if you allow expensing, you can deduct your capital investment right away, no time value of money, then it's probably not appropriate to allow full deductibility of interest. And so Congress put a limit on interest deductibility that takes away 30% of that. It's a complicated limitation that I don't have time to get into. But if you're going to conform to this, then you have there's kind of a linkage with the Section 179 and bonus changes. This will raise over $100 million per year conforming to it, but the businesses may be unhappy if you can't get your Section 179 and your bonus if you can't, if your interest deductions are limited. Congress also, as a way to provide more base expansions, changed the NOL rules, the net operating loss. This, again, for those of you who aren't familiar with sort of business returns, if you have an operating loss in a year, federal law in Minnesota for individual purposes follows the federal rules. You can file an amended return for the prior 2 years and take that loss and get a refund of tax you paid in the prior 2 years. If you can't use it all up that way, then you can carry it forward for 20 years. So as a way to raise money, the Congress cut that back. They said most businesses are no longer going to be able to carry back, and when they carry forward, they can only take 80%. If we conform to that, that's about $40 million. I'm going to hurry up so that we have time to get to the other testifiers. There are also limits that are put on employer deductions. I'll just skip over that and go to, whoops, I went too far, too fast, to talk briefly about the international provisions, which Representative Garofalo has already mentioned this. These are major, major changes that are going to have to be seriously discussed by the committee. The first one is the repatriation tax. This, as Representative Garofalo indicated before, the old system of federal taxation of international foreign operations was a worldwide system. So the federal government said to a U.S. business that had foreign operations, we're going to tax all your income and give you a foreign tax credit for the credit for the tax you paid in the foreign country, except we're not going to require you to pay that tax until you decide to voluntarily repatriate. Congress now, as Representative Garofalo said, this bill goes sort of toward, not all the way, but a lot of the way, to a territorial tax where that foreign income will be exempt. But to make the bill balance and to reflect the fact that the regime that was in place from 86, well, even before that, back to the 60s when Subpart F was enacted, but from 86 through 2017, these corporations have lots of deferred foreign earnings that were deferred under this worldwide system because they hadn't brought it back. Well, Congress said, we're going to tax all of that, but at a low rate. And so that's what this repatriation tax. If we update, we will, in theory, pick up this income, and it's a lot of income, but it's a one-time event because it's that tax on that window of income. So Congress lets them pay it over 8 years. Unless we provide in the conformity bill that they can do that, it otherwise would be payable in 1 year, and this is a tax year 17 change, so it goes back to 17. Revenue has prepared their estimate on the assumption that it will stretch out over 8 years, and that in the first, in 19, they're estimating it would raise $162 million. And that's not the total number because the economists, the federal economists, have judged correctly based on newspaper reports that there are companies who are going to not follow this deemed, and they're going to just voluntarily repatriate and pay. And so that portion of the revenue will show up in the forecast, and that so that's in addition to the 162. So with going to this new territorial system, Congress is concerned that, hey, that creates an incentive to characterize as much income as possible as foreign income, or actually to invest foreign rather than in domestically. So they included a stick and a carrot in their provisions, both of which, if we conform to, will have effect on this. The stick is this global intangible low-taxed income, which the acronym for that is GILTI. I don't know. I think somebody out there in Washington thought, okay, that would be clever. So basically what this does is treat high return income from intangibles received by foreign corporations that are controlled by the domestic, by the U.S. domestic companies as tax, as effectively the equivalent of subpart domestic income that's taxable. And this stuff is, the formulas are very complicated and the provisions are complicated. If Minnesota conforms to that, it would raise about $70 million a year. The carrot is FDII, which provides a deduction for domestic corporations that have foreign operations. This provision, because it's an incentive and a deduction, you would think it would cost us money, and in the long run it will, but because of the way the revenue estimates are, it, in the short run, it raises, it's estimated to raise revenue, but in the long run, lose revenue. Now, these are things when you put together a conformity bill, you're going to need to think about all of these one-time revenues, and do you want to make permanent commitments with that, or how do you want to handle it? And I will, the very last slide I have is just there's a lot of uncertainty and legal risk involved with these international provisions because there are, the U.S. Supreme Court, in applying the Commerce Clause, the Foreign Commerce Clause, has said it doesn't matter for a state if you're following federal law. You cannot discriminate against foreign income. If you do, that violates the Foreign Commerce Clause and you can't tax it. So we can't just blindly say because Congress has done this, we can do this. We have to be sure that we're treating the equivalent of domestic income and foreign income equally to make sure that it's constitutional. So that's another issue to keep your eye on. And with that, I'll stop and stand for any questions.
Okay, members, I'm going to shift here a little bit. We have 38 minutes, and I've got about 50 minutes of questions myself. So what we're going to do is we're going to go to House Fiscal. And then we'll have one question from Representative Lesh. I have a list here, and the list is good as gold. We save it till the next meeting. I'm going to have, and watch your emails, I'm going to have Mr. Williams and Mr. Michael back and Ms. Templin back next week to take a bunch of committee time because I know members have questions. I got a ton of questions. And so they'll be back next week. But we're not going to be able to do it today because we've got a whole list of folks that we want to start on here. So please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal.
Welcome to committee.
Thank you. Members, I have two documents that I'm going to be working off of. I have a yellow spreadsheet and a revenue estimate. The revenue estimate at the top right-hand corner is dated revised February 16th, 2018. I'm going to be kind of referencing both the documents. I just want to also note that the spreadsheet that you have before you reflects the numbers in the revenue estimate, except the only difference is that it has biennial totals and some of the footnotes are slightly different. So I just wanted to encourage you to kind of use both in tandem as we look at the estimates for federal conformity. Really quickly, for the federal law that we've been discussing today, we have received three estimates from DOR. And again, the one that we're working off today is dated February 16th. I also want to caveat this that the estimate has kind of a short shelf life because it is it will be updated after the November forecast. So continue to look for updates.
February forecast.
Yeah, what did I say? Sorry.
November.
Thank you. It'll be
November
updated
somewhere.
It'll be updated for the February forecast. Thank you very much. And so continue to look for updated revenue estimates and spreadsheets related to that. A quick comment about how the estimate, how the methodology for the estimate. Two-thirds of the estimate comes from federal spreadsheets from the Joint Committee on Taxation, and these estimates then are apportioned, you know, based on, you know, Minnesota's share, and then about one-third of the estimate comes from JCT, Joint Committee of Taxation estimates. And two-thirds of the estimate is from modeling that can be done within the Department of Revenue and within House Research. internally. And the reason why I note that is because for the part of the estimate that is modeled, we can get more information about the burden and the effect on taxpayers by income level. So I just wanted to mention that, for the part of the estimate that is modeled internally. The spreadsheet. One other thing worth noting is that this spreadsheet, and Mr. Michaels kind of alluded to that, the spreadsheet is based on the budget forecast window, obviously. Unlike the federal law, when we look at the federal spreadsheets, they have spreadsheets that go over a 10-year window, and our the state, estimate is limited to just looking at 4 years. So then that brings us to this spreadsheet, and you can see on the yellow version of this spreadsheet, and this is, again, the estimate for what Mr. Michael called the mechanical conformity. The total revenue impact is a revenue raiser of $463.9 million for the 18-19 biennium. And for the tails, it's $1.168 billion. I just want to also highlight that of that total, $303.2 million in the revenue of revenue from corporate tax in the 18-19 biennium. Of that amount, that about 69% of that revenue from corporate tax from the amount raised comes from the repatriation estimated revenue that Mr. Michael talked about. Now looking at the fiscal 2021 biennium, again, the total revenue raised is $1.168 billion. And of that amount, corporate tax raises $541.8 million of the total. And the amount from repatriation, that's the amount raised from revenue from repatriated taxes, is about 55% of that total.
Of the 541.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So the spreadsheet that you have before you, again, is based on the revenue estimate. And as you look further down into the spreadsheet, the department groups these federal provisions into 11 areas. And the first grouping is the standard deduction and exemptions. And it goes all the way down to property tax refunds. I won't go through line by line of the spreadsheet because I know you can do that. I just want to point out, of the groupings, of the 11 groupings that we have on the revenue estimate, there are only two groups that result in a net tax decrease, and that is the federal education provisions. That is the number two on the spreadsheet, the item number two, and the business investment provisions, which is item number seven. All of the other groupings in this revenue estimate are estimated to result in a net tax increase. And as you can see on the spreadsheet, that the grouping of provisions that results in the largest tax increase is the standard deduction and exemptions. For example, the sum of the increased standard deduction, increasing it to $24,000 for married joint, and the removal of the personal and dependent exemption, the subtotal for those two provisions results in $283.8 million in revenue gain in the 18-19 biennium and $474.2 million in the 2021 biennium. A couple other things to point out. One thing that we don't typically see on revenue estimates is interactions with the property tax refunds. And I just want to highlight that in the fiscal 2021 biennium, the estimate is showing a revenue impact of $169.2 million, and that would be, again, a tax increase. And that is because because the personal and dependent exemption is repealed at the federal level, and the state laws for the PTR are kind of linked to that federal law that's being repealed, and as a result of that, that would have the effect of kind of taking away the property tax refund. So they there's an interaction with that to a certain extent. So that results in, again, in $169.2 million in additional revenue that is kind of that shows up on this estimate. And then there were two questions. Representative Lesh asked, I will. Yes, please.
Let's do this. Why don't you finish your presentation, then I'm going to take one question. That's from Chair Lesh.
Okay.
And then you're going to be back next week and the next week and
again.
The next week.
I will. I plan to.
So if you want to finish your presentation, okay. Then I'm going to go to Lesh, and then we're going to Chairman Lesh, and then we're going to go to testifiers.
Mr. Chair, I just also wanted to address Representative Knobloch's question. He asked about the revenue that would the department has noted will be included as a forecast adjustment. And there are two areas where there is a forecast adjustment, and that is related to the standard deduction. The department has noted that, and I believe it's due to the consistent elections law, because the department assumes that if someone files the standard deduction at the federal level, that they will also need to file the standard deduction at the state level, and that will result in a tax increase, and that's automatically without any changes. They are including a forecast adjustment of about $60 million per year in the budget window. And that is noted in a footnote in the estimate. And in addition to that, there's also a forecast adjustment related to repatriation, and that is the voluntary repatriation of income, and that's because of the enactment of the federal law. And there is a revenue gain of about $160 million in 18 and 19 and $106 million in the 2020 biennium that the department, again, is going to include in the February forecast.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Very briefly.
Okay. Ms. Templin, so I see that on page 5 at the bottom, that footnote 2 that talks about the roughly $60 million a year. Does that include the charitable tax deduction, the special charitable tax deduction that we've got in Minnesota, the $198 million they were talking about?
Ms. Templin?
Mr. Chair, Representative Knobloch, I believe it may, but I can get back to you on that. I mean, because if they're assuming that the taxpayer files the standard deduction, they must be also making assumptions about non-itemizers, too. So I will have to check and get back to you.
No, thanks.
Thank you. So, okay, thank you so much for that presentation, members. I don't want to be cutting members off from questions. We're going to go to Chair Lesh. And then we're going to have a lot of questions for next week. Chair Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Templin, the question relates partially to the breakdown of the numbers sheet, but we've only got numbers going out to 2021 on this. And when I saw the news of the federal tax bill, it said that we're looking at 10 years out, anywhere from a half a trillion to a $2 trillion shortfall, which I realize it's different because they can deficit spend. Our numbers will be calculated in the same way, but we just can't because we can't borrow across biennia. So why is it, first of all, that, well, can you compare, can you give me an apples-to-apples comparison? I'm assuming that Minnesota is going to have somewhat of a similar situation over 10 years if we compare. And if not, why not, and does it relate to the different pots of money we tax in Minnesota versus the feds?
Ms. Templin? Or maybe Joel? Or Ms. Templin?
just really quickly, Representative Lesh. We are, again, limited to the budget forecast window from fiscal 18 to fiscal 21. And that's because of, you know, the economic assumptions that are used are based on, you know, what MMB uses. And anything beyond that is not reliable at the state level. But I guess I'll go to Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bless, it's important to keep in mind a couple things that will help you process the situation. The federal tax cut, the federal tax changes essentially include a big tax cut and base expansion that offsets that tax cut partially but not fully, and that's why the numbers you cited, the $0.5 trillion to $2 trillion. So there is a net federal tax cut, part of which offset by base changes. Those base changes flow through to Minnesota, and we benefit from that if you want to consider it a benefit. Gives us a broader tax base that we can then use to fund tax changes. The federal changes, the big cost of those changes were due to rate changes and credit changes. So the biggest change was their 35% corporate rate went to 21%. That has no impact on Minnesota. Similarly, when they jumped the child credit from $1,000 to $2,000 and let people with incomes above $115,000 get that credit, that, again, is something that doesn't flow through to Minnesota. And so what we're doing is, I think, the exercise that the Department of Revenue is going to go through and that all of you will go through is to figure out, with the base changes they gave us, how can we make offsetting changes in our tax system to come to the best tax policy that's consistent with your philosophy. But the important caveat to that is the point I was making about the repatriation tax and some of these other provisions that are one-time. If you make permanent changes based on one-time things, then you're going to end up in an unhappy, or your successors will end up in an unhappy position sometime off in the future.
And Mr. Chair, also, yeah, that the federal numbers too that we've been talking about, the $1.5 trillion, that also includes like the estate tax, the cost of the estate tax changes too. And Minnesota doesn't, you know, none of the estimates that we have before us, you know, have any of that. So, you know, the impact of Minnesota is different, you know, in terms of the total revenue cost.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Lesh. And again, members, we're going to make time for questions because this is like really important stuff here we're talking about. Okay, we're going to start off with testimony. Somebody flew in. If you want to come down, whoever flew in, and don't tell me you flew in from the St. Paul Airport. And is there anyone else on this list that is from more than 50 miles away from the Capitol? Because if people have traveled, I want to make sure we get them. Okay. I'm not going to set the timer yet. We'll see how this goes, but let's keep our testimony precise to the point. And let's start with Mr. David Ransom.
Yes, sir.
Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
My name is David Ransom. I'm at the law firm McDermott, Will & Emery in Washington, D.C., and I'm here on behalf of the American Coalition for Taxpayer Rights. Thank you, Chairman Davidson, members of the committee, for giving me a few minutes to address you regarding conformity. Our coalition is a 13-member national trade coalition that we represent the nation's largest tax preparers and the financial institutions that offer tax time products. Just very briefly, because I know time's limited, ACTR members are the most recognizable names in the industry, and their offerings include retail tax preparation, do-it-yourself tax software, and the professional tax preparation products that accountants and lawyers and others utilize as well. Our members are CCH Wolters Kluwer, H&R Block, Intuit, Jackson Hewitt, Liberty Tax, Online Taxes, Inc., Tax Act, Tax Hawk, and Tax Slayer. Those aren't all 13 members, but those are the tax preparation companies. I needed to do that for client relations. We estimate that our members help assist in the preparation and filing of approximately 100 million of the approximately 150 million federal income tax returns, and obviously they assist in millions of state filings as well. So, germane to your hearing today, Mr. Chairman, I'm here to offer the do-it-yourself tax software and professional tax preparation industry's perspective on the potential impact of federal tax conformity legislation on the industry, tax software provider products, and Minnesota tax filers, your constituents. First and foremost, I want to stress that if policymakers choose to conform Minnesota's tax laws to the recent federal tax reform changes, the sooner you do so, the better for both taxpayers and industry, ideally in the current session. Should the effort to conform be made within a few weeks of the start of the next tax filing season, or retroactively even, it would have negative implications from a tax administration standpoint. These implications include creating confusion for Minnesota taxpayers as they attempt to prepare their tax filings with or without the use of do-it-yourself tax software, and making it extremely difficult for industry to adequately address the changes to state tax law and incorporate the Department of Revenue's guidance and administration of those changes. We have attempted to detail particular scenarios that I'll discuss now. The process of conforming the state tax law to federal law obviously begins with you, policymakers, and the governor, if you agree to those changes. Then the job shifts to the revenue department, the revenue agency. The DOR must make changes to the state's tax forms and issue guidance on how certain tax laws will be administered. On the back end for e-filing, electronic filing, there are changes to the schema, which is really the package, electronic package of tax-related information that also must take place. As you can imagine, this process takes time. While some of these processes could be conducted in parallel, some cannot. Depending upon the complexity of change to state law, it may take weeks to finalize guidance, forms, and the tax schema that I mentioned. With regard to Minnesota's conformity to federal tax law, the earlier in the year, I'm being repetitive, that conformity legislation can be passed and enacted, the better, providing the State Department of Revenue with sufficient time to incorporate these changes into their forms and guidance is vital from a tax administration perspective. If you choose to conform state law to federal law, our recommendation is for the legislation to be passed this year, 2018, ideally in the current session. That should give the Department of Revenue the necessary time to provide guidance, update forms, and change its schema, and the time for industry to update and test its software, which is very important in this process. We do not recommend that changes be delayed until January 2019 or thereafter, making it retroactive. Based on the timing previously described, passing a conformity bill in January or later for the 2018 tax filing season would have a significant impact on Minnesota taxpayers. At that time, both the Department of Revenue and industry have to make changes immediately upon the law taking effect for essentially a go-live tax filing season to launch in that same month. For significant changes in this short window, we're talking here if the changes conformity occurs late in 2018 or even in 2019, for significant changes in this short window may force a delay to the beginning of the tax filing season. Similar complications would occur if conforming legislation is passed in 2019, which I just described, requiring that it apply retroactively after the start of the tax filing season. In addition to the delays described above, the retroactive timing creates significant confusion for taxpayers, businesses, tax professionals, and industry. Many in the industry will be uncertain as to what they need to do or how they need to do it. Our members have had experience with this scenario and unfortunately have found that many taxpayers do not go back and file an amended return. This, of course, hits them as they file the following year's return and can be a cause of financial strain. This scenario also creates a large burden for the Department of Revenue. So in conclusion, if you choose to conform state law to federal law, our group, that is the actor, the coalition we represent, strongly recommends that a conformity bill be passed and signed within the regular 2018 legislative session. Changes to the tax law that are passed shortly before the beginning of the tax season or are retroactive, as I mentioned, are likely to introduce a significant burden to the Department of Revenue, increased risk for tax software products, and likely confusion and financial strain for taxpayers. I appreciate your time this morning and would answer any questions that you might have. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. I think we're going to go on. I want to get the CPAs down. Thank you very much. If you could hang around maybe afterwards, if members have questions, they could talk to you. When's your flight leave?
2:30.
We'll get you out here by 2:15. So I want CPAs because I know this is kind of like your really busy time and you probably don't want to come back. Everybody would want to come back, but you guys are busy, and I understand that. So please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Chair Davids. My name is Todd Koch. I'm a CPA with the firm John A. Knudsen & Company and also a member of the Minnesota Society of CPAs.
Good morning. My name is Elizabeth Beistrom. I am a CPA here in Minnesota and also a member of the MNCPA.
Okay. Do you know what a CPA is? An actuary with a personality. In other words, really smart. Really smart. Okay, who would like to start?
Thank you for taking up conformity so early in the session. A lot of what I've heard today is talking about the major tax bill that did pass. It was signed on December 22nd. But we're really worried about trying to get things done for 2017 tax returns. There are provisions within that bill that directly impact 2017 returns that we strongly encourage you to, we need to know, like, in the next 10 days what you're going to do, or we're going to have to extend everybody's returns, which is fine, but you have to know the practical. I don't want a change to be made right before the deadline. That's not good for you. It's not good for me. It's not good for the Department of Revenue.
Sure, so, I'll guarantee you we won't be done by then.
No, but it's important that you know the issues that are there.
Right, absolutely.
Because as a practical matter, the time frames we're talking about, that it just takes to get software changes done, get the schema that they're talking about done, and get it before we have actually prepared the returns is really difficult. So we'll be explaining to our small business taxpayers, most of which, if they bought equipment, so that's where a lot of the differences are, that are a retroactive change. The equipment purchased after September 27th, 2017 has some new depreciation rules in the bill that was passed and signed on December 22nd. However, there was another bill that was just passed in the extenders that were included in the government financing bill that was just signed February 9th that also has retroactive changes that impact more of the individuals. So while the depreciation changes impact small businesses and large businesses like Cargill, a lot of the conformity provisions in the bill, the extenders bill that was passed February 9th really impact people more like my kids. And yes, they are directly impacted by these changes. So there are changes that need to go through. We just need to know how to prepare even 2017 returns, let alone the large changes trying to figure out for 18 and forward. Because right now, for us to try and figure out how to do a depreciation schedule, you have to do each asset under two different ways, part one way, part another way. It is just a literal nightmare, and it really increases the cost to our clients. And we're one of the few groups here that are asking to be paid less, not more. So we want to help people conform with the rules. And it's not just 18 and forward. It's also 17.
Ms. Beistrom.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'll be brief. As I said earlier, my name is Elizabeth Beistrom. I'm proud to be a CPA here in the state of Minnesota. As a member of the MNCPA, I really am honored to be here today, so thank you. I run my own tax practice in Wiper Lake, and this will be my 18th tax season, and yes, it is a busy time of year for me and Todd. I prepare individual income and business tax returns for my clients. telling my clients that they owe taxes is one of my least favorite things to do, second only to getting my teenage daughters out of bed in the morning. Without federal conformity in Minnesota, I believe I'll be forced to explain to these clients that despite the intention of the federal government to lower taxes for Americans, Minnesota has not gotten on board with that, and the result is we'll have to add some of those deductions back to their income when we calculate what they owe to Minnesota. It's not a conversation I relish having. I appreciate your willingness to consider federal conformity as a top priority in this legislative session. I think it's one of the most important and urgent matters on the agenda because I really, truly believe that it is what is best for Minnesota. As we've heard this morning, conformity could deliver a consistent tax cut at the state level as promised by the new tax law. It'll keep more money in business owners' pockets so they can grow and invest in Minnesota businesses. It'll help all Minnesotans plan for their 2018 tax bill in 2017, as Todd has mentioned, and remove uncertainty that may delay critical decision-making for both individuals and business owners alike. Conformity will not only reduce complexity and simplify the tax filing process, it'll reduce costs for both taxpayers and the Minnesota Department of Revenue as they attempt to administer the tax code. As a tax preparer, a member of the MNCPA, and a taxpayer myself, I support swift federal conformity, and I ask you to as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming, and thank you for what you do.
Thank you.
We'll try to make your lives easier as best we can. Okay, let's go to Mr. Paul Egger, Vice President, Government Relations, Minnesota Realtors. Now let's get Mr. Hickey, if you could sit next to Paul there, or Mr. Egger.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity to testify. Again, my name is Paul Egger, and I'm with the Minnesota Realtors Association, representing over 18,000 realtors across Minnesota. Thank you for beginning this really important conversation so early in the session. The federal law made numerous changes to the federal tax code, including provisions affecting current and prospective homeowners, which you've heard about in various presentations this week, so I won't repeat all of those provisions. I do want to state, though, Mr. Chairman, that we want to work with you as more information becomes available throughout the session regarding potential impacts to different types of taxpayers and consider potential proposals for addressing any adverse impacts. Ms. Templin mentioned the provisions that indirectly affect the property tax refund program. The Department of Revenue's preliminary estimate also addresses this issue, and I'll just quote from what they included in their estimate, which is, quote, the federal provisions increase the household income amount used to calculate PTR, which would reduce state-paid refunds to more than 500,000 homeowners and renters beginning in fiscal year 2020. We believe the PTR is a very important program. It provides tax relief to homeowners as property taxes are high relative to their incomes, and we hope that mitigating the reductions to PTR refunds will be an issue that receives a lot of attention in this committee this year. I also just want to briefly mention, as the previous testifier, that on February 9th, the federal Congress passed the Bipartisan Budget Act 2018, and that includes the tax extenders for 2017, including a couple of home ownership provisions that this committee has conformed with regularly, the mortgage debt forgiveness provision, and also the mortgage insurance premium provision. Lastly, Mr. Chair, we look forward to working with you and the committee as you consider changes to state tax policy this session in response to the federal legislation, and we will try to assist you in identifying opportunities to support homeowners and homeownership in the conformity bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Egger. We'll go to Mr. Hickey and then Ms. Cadoon, if you want to come down, if we get the two of you at the table there. And I think we're probably going to be wrapping up, and then I'm just going right down the list, and then we'll start with Nan Madden next week when we take testimony. Mr. Hickey, please introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business, and I appreciate the chance to make a few brief comments here today. What a game changer the new federal tax law was, the first time since 1981, and what a unique opportunity we have to make significant changes in a tax structure that we feel is really uncompetitive in this state and is harmful to our economic growth and harmful to growth of small business. At the same time, what tremendous challenges. I need to go back and rewatch the House research tape. That was informative and overly complex, and I need to watch it a few more times. But some of the items that we think would be very helpful for small business, if we could comply with the 20% pass-through tax deduction for flow-through companies, would be so helpful for a lot of small businesses in our state. We feel we're overtaxed, especially our most successful small businesses, and this could help a lot. But it'll help any business, no matter where they sit on the tax structure, no matter where their rates are. And this was something that Congress was trying to do. They were trying to do two things. They were trying to encourage American businesses to stay here and to grow. So they did a dramatic cut on the corporate rate, but they needed to do something for small business, too. In my organization, National Federation of Independent Business was a really loud voice for that, that this had to be a balanced package. And so the final provision was the 20% tax deduction for pass-through companies. And that would be very helpful if we could do that. We'd also like to make some progress on Section 179 expensing. We are far, far out of conformity right now after the federal acted. And I've had many unhappy members call me about the current Section 179 expensing arrangement with the mere $25,000 deduction and the five-year add-back. I've had a lot of complaints about that over the years. If we could at least get rid of the add-back and try to get somewhere close to what the federal did, I realize $1 million is very high, maybe sky high in some people's judgments. But if we could make progress on that, that would be very helpful. The same with the estate tax. I know maybe a sore spot with the governor, Mr. Chairman, based on what he said yesterday. But, you know, we're at $3 million per person, and the federal has jumped all the way to 11 per person now. And the worse that gap gets, the more incentive it gives people to start thinking about moving things around, especially if they've reached a point in their life where they can afford to not be here for several months in the winter. It's not hard to stay a little longer and get out of a whole lot of Minnesota taxes. And so finally, you know, this is obviously a tremendous challenge here. It's a real mixed bag of results for Minnesota taxpayers. But, Mr. Chairman, possibly one solution would be to try to cut Minnesota rates across the board to make up for lost deductions and other penalties taxpayers are going to feel. And so if that is something that could be considered or done, that might be one solution with all the new revenue coming in to try to blunt the impact of that. So I look forward to being in this hearing, this room many times, trying to keep up with all this. But thanks for the chance to speak today.
Thank you, Mr. Hickey. And again, to those that are testifying, let's talk about conformity here. As best we can. Please state your name, who you represent for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Beth Cadoon. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I appreciate the opportunity to testify, and as was requested, we'll limit the comments really just to address the issue of complication of not having a tax bill. Hopefully that point has been hammered home, where we certainly agree there is a need for a tax bill. If we don't do it, I don't think you can underestimate the complexity that will be caused for Minnesota taxpayers, Minnesota businesses, so we certainly agree for the need to do that and have that resolved this session. I would also mention that obviously we're ready to work with the committee and look forward to doing that, working with the committee and the chairs, because obviously it's going to be the details of the tax bill that are really going to be important, so we look forward to those conversations. We do believe there's, I think people are agreeing on the need to mitigate the tax increases that will incur on Minnesotans. We agree with that as well. But we also want to discuss the opportunities that we're going to think are presented with the federal tax bill and the opportunities to look at our tax structure to see how we can make our system more pro-growth, to really encourage that private sector investment, entrepreneurship, talent, retention, and migration. So we look forward to those conversations. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Cadoon. As you can see, the clock kind of got away from us here, but I'd like to thank the Department of Revenue for your participation in today's hearing. I'd like to thank House Research, House Fiscal. And members, thank you for your work. We have a lot more to do. We're going to pick up on this on Tuesday. So to the testifiers, I'm down through the chamber. We'll start off with Nan Madden, Minnesota Budget Project, and just down. So I would save a lot of this stuff, members. Might be a good idea. And I have members' questions here. I've got that list, too. So We'll get a lot more questions in. And so with that, members, good government all the time. We are adjourned.